Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin today's program with an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 1st of December. This article was written by Lindsay Ellis, and the title is "Americans' Long Love-Hate Relationship with Work." From the Protestant work ethic to rage quitting, American attitudes about their work are driven by its promise of prosperity and its precarious nature. In order to understand how Americans feel about their work, consider two often cited but seemingly contradictory philosophies. First, there's the American dream, the belief that hard work can bring prosperity. And second, there's the chart-topping country song, "Take This Job and Shove It." They are two sides of the same coin, the hope that work will move us above our station and our disappointment when it doesn't happen as promised. Ever since the founding of the country, Americans have defined themselves by their work and by the wealth and status it can bring. Benjamin Franklin argued that hard work was essential for success. In the late 1800s, there were the Horatio Alger stories extolling the idea that the new country was the land of opportunity, where people could go from poverty to wealth because of what they did for a living. More recently, though, you can find the same faith in tales of climbing the corporate ladder, "I started in the mailroom," or the rise of a celebrity entrepreneur. Today, teachers ask grade schoolers what they want to be when they grow up, and children respond with an occupation. The second question Americans ask strangers at parties after their name is, "What do you do?" But with so much writing on work, we cannot help but be let down. That has never been more true than in modern America. In recent decades, work has taken on even more importance, promising not just money, benefits, and a sense of identity, but also community, purpose, and belonging. Millennials were told to follow their passion in commencement speeches by Oprah Winfrey, by Steve Jobs, and by Jim Carrey. Anything less would be considered a disappointment. A longer share of Americans responding to the World Value Survey in 2017 said work was important in their life than those who said religion, 79.7% versus 60.7%. Little wonder, then, that in a recent Wall Street Journal NORC poll, 69% said they believe the American dream does not hold true, the highest in nearly 15 years of surveys. Even when we grouse about our jobs by the water cooler and over Slack, the complaint is rarely about working hard. It's about the lack of agency and the fears for the future. In "Take This Job and Shove It," the protagonist notably was not disenchanted with hard work. Instead, he felt like 15 years of working for a fool did not get him what he wanted. People are really getting a sense of disillusionment coming from, in part, the pervasive insecurity and also the dismantling of fundamental protections, says Stephen Sweet, executive officer of the Work and Family Researchers Network and a sociologist at Ithaca College. Among them, he says, the weakening of union contracts, the decline of pensions, and companies backing away from long-term employment of workers. Such precarity, Sweet says, keeps us working. It also keeps us dreaming of the day we can walk out that door or be successful enough to be our own boss or not work at all. We work because we have to, we work because we want to, and then we get manipulated, Sweet says. We're choosing to send emails on vacation. We cannot pull ourselves away from the line from the office. Three generations of the Boker family, aged 93, 57, and 22, all trained as engineers and all living in the Tampa, Florida area, show how expectations intersect with ambition and disappointment, particularly in the post-World War II period, when many more Americans began pursuing professional careers. Peter Bokor was a Hungarian refugee who escaped in 1956 with nightmares of Russian tanks. Jeff Bokor saw work as an entree to a social class he aspired to as a young man. And Tyler Bokor, a recent graduate, is entering the workforce as the very nature of work is changing. Peter Bokor, the grandfather, spent several years driving a cab in Toronto, grateful just to be alive. But once he made it to Washington, D.C., in 1963, he had greater professional ambitions. He wanted to use his engineering background. He said he walked into an engineering firm and asked to be hired at the lowest possible salary as a junior draftsman. "Just let me through the door," he recalls saying. And it worked, but eventually he grew irritated as he turned out designs faster than his colleagues for far less pay. "I went to the VP and I complained," he says, "but an executive told him, 'This is not a democratic institution. We are a profit-making business.'" Peter thanked him and stayed at the job, he says. Later, he joined many contractors working in nuclear power plants and refineries across the country. Precarity was part of life. After each project, he would drive his van to another town, another contract. His children and their mother stayed in Florida. It was an era where men were the primary breadwinners in most households. It was not easy, he says, and he had to make sure he had enough money to bridge unemployment periods. Less security, more rewards. Sweet, the work and family researchers network leader, says the 1973 economic downturn was a line in the sand. From there, unionization declined and wages stagnated as inflation soared. The following decade, he said, workers were given a new bargain. They could not expect security, but they could be rewarded if they did their jobs well. People start recalibrating how they're going to run their life, Sweet says. The insecurity, in part, drives the need to be working really hard, really long, without interruption. You have to do that in order to get the security that is vanishing. Then Peter's son, Jeff Bokor, understands that trade-off. He grew up seeing work as a way to catapult himself into a new social class. He dreamed of being a professional football or baseball player or a millionaire, envisioning life as a jet-setting businessman. Growing up, Jeff says, his crushes, who lived on the far side of the lake, the wealthy side, would not date him. That put a chip on his shoulder. "I was going to get on that side of the lake." His father, tormented by his own experience, advised him to refocus on work he could do anywhere in the world. "I was a cocky, arrogant American boy," Jeff says. "I said, 'Dad, this is the USA. We're not going to get invaded anytime soon. I'm not going to have to go through what you went through." Still, Jeff did pivot to electrical engineering, hoping to net a good salary. He waited tables through college, and then he took 9 years to graduate. His first job's pay at $28,000 did not measure up to what his friends were making, he says. He ultimately pivoted into sales, doubling his salary. The downside? He was working nonstop, especially after he got a laptop and cell phone. "All of a sudden, work was coming home with me," he says. "You couldn't get away from it." Then, after the 2008 financial crisis, he was out of a job. "Your heart starts beating. You feel that knot, almost like a death in the family," he says. "It's like, holy crap, what the heck am I going to do?" A 2011 Newsweek magazine cover stuck with him. It showed a man in a suit lying flat on the sand as a wave retreated. Epidemic alert, the beached white male. He had a big job, a big office, a big bonus. Now he's all washed up and doesn't have a freaking prayer. Jeffrey calls his responsibilities flashing before his eyes, his family and his children. I thought I was on top of the world, bulletproof, he says. That wasn't the case. The Heidrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University found that 73% of Americans either themselves lost a job between 2009 and 2013 or had someone close to them lose a job. There was anxiety before that, says Carl Van Horn, the center's director, but the recession exposed an even greater anxiety. For many, it fueled Americans to avoid taking time off. They're afraid if they do that, the boss, whoever he or she is, will consider them less productive or therefore more expendable, he says. So Jeff focused on his technical skills and working for himself. He found short-term work for former clients. He made less money, but his hours eased. Loving work and hating the job. As Jeff Bocor learned, modern times had solidified as an always-on work culture and once again created a backlash. When Brenda Bartella Peterson was in her late 30s, leading a women's club in Lexington, Kentucky, she and her peers were questioning their options. The 80s were just driven, work, 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 she says. By the 90s, they wondered, is this what my life is going to be like? Peterson saw that tension firsthand, initially in wanting to work and then in feeling the downsides of that decision. Her husband, she says, wanted her to stay at home. I really pushed against that, she says. After he died, she thought, okay, this is my opportunity to have the career that I want. She joined the speaker circuit in the early 1990s, giving talks about work-life balance, self-esteem, and time management at computer conferences and for other professional groups. But she found that balancing it all was not easy. She remembers her older son saying at one point that she was worthless as a mother. Especially as a single mother, it's just hard, she says. Peterson, now 77, is a retired minister and finds work integrated into who I am. Though she coached others to make space for their lives, she still sees work as a core to her identity. I cannot separate who I am from how I work. Meanwhile, lurk in the latter half of the 20th century to the present day has become even less certain. The number of people usually working part-time has nearly tripled since 1968, says the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We have allowed employment to become more and more precarious, even as we have created a system in which the only way to fully access benefits is to fully participate, says Sarah Damask, a sociology professor at Pennsylvania State University, adding that health insurance, SNAP, unemployment insurance, and Social Security are tied to work and having a work history. Losing a livelihood. The COVID-19 pandemic ruptured the relationship between workers and their bosses, says Damask, the Penn State professor. First, more than 20 million Americans lost their job, an experience where many question whether they should trust their employer, she says. Second, many employers required in-person work without taking necessary safety steps. And third, after many people came to enjoy remote work, companies cut that perk. Even people with what I would consider very elite professional jobs are starting to make more distinctions between themselves and the job, Damask says. She says, is a significant cultural shift. COVID-19 drove Brandeis Marshall, 47 to the brink in her university computer science department. A tiny minority of PhDs in computer science are black women, and achieving her position was a significant career milestone, one that Miles Marshall says came from opportunities that were not afforded to her parents, a commercial plumber turned accountant, and a hospital ward secretary. Though she had netted the prestigious title, the job itself was a letdown. Marshall was working on weekends and answering work emails late at night, scheduling them to send in the morning so that colleagues would not notice. She says she threw out her back and realized her overwork created physical strain on her, and she didn't trust her bosses anymore to support her. Her colleagues boycotted teaching in person, concerned that what they saw as inadequate COVID-19 safety precautions. "This is ridiculous," she remembers thinking. "I cannot continue. Life is too short." Fading opportunity. Artificial intelligence is again recalibrating the relationship between Americans and their jobs as technology eats up the prestigious white-collar work that both consumed waking hours and had been a point of pride. Tyler Bocor, Jeff's son, studied engineering like his father and grandfather did, but he enters the workforce with his own expectations and questions. He fears that artificial intelligence is going to narrow the opportunities available to entry-level workers. Executives at Amazon.com and Ford Motor have said AI will translate to hiring fewer workers for the types of corporate jobs that have long been sought after. Busy work that required long hours crunched over a computer is happening autonomously, and entry-level workers are now struggling to gain a career foothold and the professional status coming from white-collar work. The technology further frays the relationship between bosses and staff, particularly because of entry-level cuts, says Ghislaine St. Just, who is a chief executive officer and president of NABA, the Association of Black Business Leaders. Companies treat workers as even more expendable, while workers, too, have a backup plan, side hustles or other gig work in case they get laid off. "The thing we call work, I think, is going to become a lot more complex," St. Just says. As the jobs that once required degrees are offloaded to technology, companies must now consider how they will develop talent, as young workers are asking, "How do I earn a living to live a life I find fulfilling?" In May, Tyler graduated from the University of Florida without a job. He was stressed, applying widely for jobs, and moved in with his dad. Although he made strong grades, he wondered if he should have sought more internships to give him a professional edge, like many other Americans, wondering if he had worked enough. "You always compare yourself to other people," he says. Then he got an interview and an offer. The role was an electronics engineering internship at the architectural tech company BubblyNet. He travels to client sites and is trying to learn from experienced colleagues about designing and programming hardware. Tyler looks at his dad and his grandfather's early work experiences and cannot believe the contrast with his own. His grandfather asked to be hired at the lowest possible wage, and it resulted in a job. His father was promoted in his first several months at work. Their disappointments came later on, but at least there were plenty of opportunities at the outset. His father, Jeff, hopes that Tyler will not have to face the same disappointments that he faced of being let down after getting consumed by his job. But he wonders whether it's inevitable, part of how work is in America, he says. "As much as I want to think that I'm putting him on my shoulders to give him that advantage in life, he's going to face challenges," Jeff says. There's no way around it. As for Tyler, he has reached the first rung of the ladder in a nation where work is consuming, challenging, and at times disappointing. But now when he introduces himself to new people, Tyler can answer the second question they ask. For the next article today, I'd like to go back to an article I started reading for you last week and found that we ran out of time before we could finish. The article is from the Wall Street Journal, November 24th, and the title is Two Sisters, How Artificial Intelligence Affects Their Different Career Paths. This article was written by Julie Jargon. The Talley sisters are in the early stages of building their careers. One sister feels her path as artificial intelligence proof, and the other, not so much. Sophia Talley is 22 and decided during her freshman year of high school that she wanted to write long form, magazine-style nonfiction pieces. The world was a different place then. It would be some 5 years before generative artificial intelligence would be out in the wild, stringing together words as well as many humans. Now shaky job prospects have her worried and in financial limbo. Her sister Hannah is 25 and dropped out of college 4 years ago to become an auto mechanic. She feels stable with a steady paycheck. An uncertain job market for young adults today, spurred in part by the increasing sophistication and use of artificial intelligence in the workplace, is having broad ripple effects. Some workers are migrating to skilled trades. White-collar employees are under pressure to level up their AI skills, and parents are trying to figure out just how to guide their college-age kids. Career counselors are also advising young adults to sharpen their people skills, develop AI expertise, and to be ready to pivot. The Texas sisters' divergent career paths reflect the shifting dynamics. White-collar jobs that once seemed so solid are no longer so, and some skilled blue-collar work is looking like a safer bet. The difference in their career situations for these sisters is made stark by a recent Microsoft research paper that analyzed the role of artificial intelligence in the workplace. The analysis found that while 85% of writers and authors' work overlaps with tasks already performed frequently by AI, only 19% of the auto mechanics tasks were ones that bots commonly do now. Sophia always loved creative writing, and she began to envision a career as a journalist at the encouragement of a high school English teacher. She majored in rhetoric and writing at the University of Texas in Austin. She graduated in May and is living at home with her parents in San Antonio. Her dream of landing a full-time journalism job has yet to materialize. She works three contract jobs, totaling about $30,000 in annual wages, not enough to pay rent today and other bills. Sophia writes 2 to 3 articles a month for Austin Monthly Magazine, does copy editing for a media group, and handles brand communications for a nonprofit foundation. Sophia has gotten her gigs through people she knows and has lost confidence in finding work through online job sites. Many of the verified listings she sees are for seasoned reporters, and when she applies, she rarely hears back. She suspects that her resume never reaches a real person out there because of artificial intelligence filters. I know I have to pay my dues, she says, but it's difficult to find a job that uses my degree in the way I imagined. A class Sophia took in college on artificial intelligence and society convinced her that technological advancements do not eliminate the need for human skills, they just reshape them. Sophia says she thinks AI will reduce demand for more rote forms of writing, but that it won't be able to tell the kind of human stories that she wants to write. So in moments of doubt, Sophia has considered a fallback plan, which was to get a certification in AI prompt writing. But she might need a fallback for her fallback. That once hot job has been rendered obsolete as artificial intelligence has become better at understanding poorly written prompts. And she's only just begun on her journey. I'm not at the point yet where I'm willing to compromise writing full-time, she says. The parents, Patrick and Janine Talley, who always have supported their daughter's career choices, are now seeing the impact of artificial intelligence in their own jobs. Patrick works in portfolio management for a financial services company and has been using AI to get better and faster at his work. At my company, they say you won't be replaced by AI, but you might be replaced by someone who knows it better than you do, he says. Janine works in human resources for a health insurance company and leaned heavily on AI during a job search 2 years ago. She used AI tools to optimize her LinkedIn profile, to create professional photos, and to polish her resume. In her current job, she's using artificial intelligence to generate answers to frequently asked questions from employees and to provide custom recommendations on how workers can advance in the organization. AI is not going away, and I think it's about figuring out how you can use it to differentiate yourself, Janine says. It does worry me a bit more in Sophia's field, but now there is an art to being a high-quality writer and telling a narrative. Hannah, the mechanic, grew up during a time when girls were encouraged to pursue STEM careers. She went to Texas A&M to study engineering, but when her hands-on lab classes stopped because of COVID, college became less enjoyable. She began to think about what she really loved. Ever since she was very young, she enjoyed hanging out with her grandpa and helping him work on his collection of classic cars. One Halloween, she dressed up as Disney's cartoon car, Lightning McQueen. When Hannah told her parents she wanted to drop out of college, they were supportive, but said she would need to get a job. Some family members questioned her decision, she says, but her sister, Sophia, was her biggest champion. So Hannah applied for an entry-level position at a Firestone shop and got it. She's been there now for more than 4 years and is advancing. Even if AI were to give people better answers, what is it going to do to the car? The artificial intelligence does not have hands, Hannah says. This is all we have time for on our program on careers for today. I hope you've enjoyed listening and will enjoy the rest of your day as well. And thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.